That's why I think a door must have closed or something, cause I don't see a door there or anything. It's just all smooth. There are a few other characters in this room also. There are like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there are about 5 or 6 of them, cause they're kind of scattered around against the walls with their hands behind their backs. Chuckles, they look like guards or something. I don't know what they need guards for. I'm sure not going anywhere. Especially the way I feel. It's kind of a light now, out of the ceiling, out of the center. It's coming actually out of the center where this big device is hooked up. And it shines on me. Kinda warm. Feels good. It was getting a little bit cold in there. It feels good now. My back feels better, too. Now it hurts, hurts again. Winces, they want me to turn over, on my stomach. And, I don't think, they're going to miss anything, they're going to get me from all angles. Sighs, I'm really getting bored being in there. I want this thing to be over. Whatever they plan to do, do it. Get it over with. I feel something touching that spot where it itched. I don't know, what, I think it's the mark on my back that they want to look at. To see what it is, I think. I think I have something on my back, some kind of a mole or something. Yeah, they're touching it. AC, how does it feel when they touch it? SK, it's hard. I mean, his finger, or whatever he's touching it with, is hard. Yeah, I think, chuckles. He sure is looking closely. He's leaning over, and his head is like, strange the way his head turns down. I didn't notice any of them do that before. It's like on a joint or something. His head is very, and I do see his neck. I didn't know he had a neck, chuckles, but he does. It's a little skinny thing. But he turns and it's just like, I think his neck can bend. It's strange. Anyway, he's looking, he's really getting close to my back. AC, where on your back is it? SK, it's on the right side, a little bit lower than the middle, and, he kind of pushes on it and it hurts a little. AC, what does his finger feel like as it touches you? SK, very solid. It's heavy. AC, does it feel warm? SK, no, I don't feel any temperature. I mean, it must be the exact same temperature as my body, or something, cause I don't feel any difference. It's very hard. Like, just the way it looks. It looks like hard plastic and it feels hard. I don't know how he could possibly feel anything with a hard finger like that. Oh. He had some kind of, chuckles, pushed at it with his finger, on the edge. That's funny, when he touched it, the little thing on my back, it hurt farther down. AC, where does it hurt? SK, farther down, where, my back hurt. Where that thing was hitting my back and hurting, lower. Sighs, now he's just pushing on it, pushing down on it. I think he just wants to feel it. I don't know what the great fascination is. It's strange, but what I can't figure out is he's so short, and this table sits up really high. And yet when he leans over to touch it he can look down on it. I really don't understand how he can do that. It doesn't make any sense to me. I'm trying to look down at his feet but I can't see them. He must be standing on something, is the only thing I can think. Chuckles, unless he's floating. Chuckles, maybe he is. Oh. He pushed that spot on my back with his hand. He should leave it alone. It hurts. The other guy, the boss the who walked me in, now has his back partially turned. Maybe he can't stand the sight of blood. I keep getting the feeling that my back is open, but there's no blood. Or that it's not cut or anything. I get the feeling that they're looking inside of it. My leg, my right leg especially, going down my right leg, it feels a little bit numb. Also like it's falling asleep. And the pain goes up my back, the right side. Now, it's my stomach. This thing, they turn me on my left side now and I'm lying on my left side. My stomach hurts. Right side of my stomach, almost right on the opposite side of where my back hurts. A dull pain. Sort of a stomach ache. I'm getting sleepy there. I don't know whether they're doing it or if I'm just getting sleepy. Yeah, I'm really comfortable. Sighs. Awkward position to be lying in. I'm lying on my left arm. My arm is straight down along my side. Something is poking my stomach. I mean, not poking into, on the outside it's poking. Chuckles, I keep thinking an X-ray would be quicker. Ah. Clamp. Kind of like the thing that was on my shoulder, only it's rounder, it's on my hip, my right hip. That's what, very short breakers tape is turned over. Oh. A rod now, it's just poking into my dot. Chuckles. I can see the color of this. This is dark, this is like a dark gray. Just poking it up against, like almost tapping. Really, it comes from that thing. That thing has come down again, and I see it's like a rod, it's like a wand, tapping against my stomach, slowly. I see it sliding back and forth, tap, slowly it moves back, tap, and it pushes against my stomach. It almost looks as if it's made of lead. It's almost that color. I don't see any lines or anything. It's perfectly shaped. Cylindrical, kind of very skinny, though. And, 84, it's flat on the end. Not hollow. Sure is poking into my stomach, though. Right on there, sighs, on the side. I'm looking back at that other guy standing there, the one who brought me in, and I see the back of his head, now. It's almost perfectly round. Ugly little thing. And I think there's a line. I don't even know if that's skin on his head. A very, very faint line like a ripple. Like a seam. Chuckles, right down the middle. I can't tell if it's skin or something he has over his head. It fits well, though. Chuckles. He has the tiniest little chest. I can't see any ribs. Just, there's no muscular definition or anything. He turns around, and he sees I'm looking at him, and I don't think he's too crazy about the idea. Chuckles, so I look away. The supervisor in this room is the other guy, though. It's like he's the boss and he just took over once we got into this room. That thing is gone, now. The thing moved up into the ceiling and the light isn't on me anymore. And I'm lying on my back now. I do that myself, though. I knew they wanted me on my back and maybe they just let me do it, instead of forcing me. Now there, our doctor, I don't know what else to call him. He's coming over and he's looking at that spot on my stomach. It tickles a little bit. Chuckles, he feels it. A little sensitive. Still don't understand how he can be looking down, he's so short. I almost feel, lying there, I'm almost high, just a little bit dizzy. But I'm very relaxed. I feel like a frog. Chuckles. Now there's a metal thing comes up around both my legs. It's very skinny. Moves my legs apart a little bit. It's almost, comes right up under my legs as high as it can go. And they want to feel what's on my skin. My right leg, moves my right leg all the way up. That's why I feel like a frog. The doctor now touches my skin under that, my leg, inside my leg. It feels, I got goosebumps a little bit. It feels kinda rough. Anyway. He's certainly interested in it. He goes back and feels my stomach again, the spot on it, on the right side. My right hand is now paralyzed. I want to move but I can't. My left one is just relaxed, but my right one, isn't. It's falling asleep, there's no feeling in it. Now my left one's getting numb. It's happening fast. It starts from there, God, it happened fast. It starts from the fingertips and it goes right to the elbows, right up to the shoulders. They're both totally paralyzed. There's no pain, though. I just feel that I have no feeling. God, I'm even more relaxed than I was before. Sighs. I'm almost asleep, but not quite. Now my legs. My leg is down again. The two metal things dash. Saw the color, they're dark also. They come off and they're gone. I don't know where they went. My legs are now paralyzed. My back still hurts a little bit, though. I think they're trying to knock me out. They sure did it. This seemed to be a logical place to end the session, so I signaled Dr. Claymore and she began the process of bringing Stephen out of the trance state. He was told that he would be able to integrate this experience into his life, that it would not cause him any difficulty, that he would be relaxed. Immediately upon awakening from the trance, Steve complained that his ears bothered him. He felt a peculiar pressure not unlike that experienced in an airplane during a sudden shift of altitude. It was an unusual reaction, one I had never observed before, but the problem was gradually eased by repeated yawning and swallowing. The hypnotic period had lasted for about an hour and had been filled with precise and fascinating new details, but it had been unnerving for all three of us. Stephen and I said goodbye to Aphrodite and went out to a coffee shop on Lexington Avenue to talk further about what we had learned. These debriefing sessions, to use the wooden NASA phrase, have always yielded important information, and the basic reason is this: as the subject in the hypnotic state tree experiences the encounter, he, or she, tells only what seems to be most tellable at the moment, what he judges to be most immediately significant. But other peripheral things are also being re-experienced, and it is only later, in a more leisurely setting, that these other, less obviously important details can be recounted. For instance, Stephen now mentioned what we had perceived as a gap in his narrative. When he first entered the big, whitish room, he walked towards the table, which he said grew straight out of the floor like a mesa, and which was about chest high. The next moment, he was seated on the table nearly naked, and his clothes were nowhere to be seen. One can speculate either that he has repressed the disturbing experience of being stripped and lifted onto the table, or that he may have been, in fact, unconscious during that operation. My observations of the hypnotic recall of various abductees suggests that in almost every case there seems to be a period of missing time when the subject is probably unconscious, and thus unable, even through hypnosis, to remember anything. During a phone conversation 2 days later, Steve recalled some other details, particularly about the final moments of his examination. The thin, round metal loops which raised and slightly spread his legs must have come up from the surface of the table. They completely encircled his thighs very high up, almost at the level of his hip sockets, and the ultimate effect was to force him into a posture not unlike that which results from obstetrical stirrups. As he phrased it at the time, "I feel like a frog." He also mentioned a peculiar emotional reaction he had after he had relived this examination through hypnosis. "I felt embarrassed, somehow ashamed, the way you would feel if you had flunked a test or something and tried to conceal it from your parents." He recalled that, when he came home that fateful morning in 1973, he felt physically dirty, and wanted very much to shower, though he was so tired that he gave up on the idea and just went to bed. He definitely had the sense that he had withheld some details of his ordeal from Dr. Claymore and myself, though he wasn't sure what they might be. "I really don't like to think about it," he said. "I'm trying to put the whole thing out of my mind." One final detail, however, was particularly interesting. At some point towards the end of the examination, Stephen said that the doctor held a whitish, cylindrical object like a wand in his hand. I asked how thick it was in relation to Steve's thumb. "Over twice as thick," he answered, "and about 7 or 8 inches long. It appeared to be very heavy, and seemed to be regarded by the others as highly significant, as if it were the most important part of the entire operation." For a short time, he recalls, this tubular implement with a rounded end was placed against his chest. As we shall see when we consider other abduction cases, this short, plain cylindrical device is indeed a ubiquitous tool. Sergeant Charles Moody, taken from his car near Alamogordo, New Mexico, in 1975-15, described being touched on his back by a small, rod-like device while sitting on a slab-like plastic or metal table which was like a solid block sitting on the floor. In there, Casey County, Kentucky, abduction, 1 ton: I. Miss Mona Stafford described while under hypnosis, lying on a white table while experiencing the impression that her right arm was somehow pinned or fastened and her leg was forced back under her rather painfully. Similarly, her friend, Miss Elaine Thomas, recalled a bullet-shaped object, about an inch, and, one, half in diameter, being placed on her left chest. Like so many other aspects of the UFO phenomenon, the patterns closely repeat themselves and the descriptions from case to case contain remarkable similarities. We have the data but lack the explanations, and it is partly my purpose in writing this book to stimulate others, psychologists, neurologists, physicists, statisticians, in fact, intellectuals and scientists of whatever disciplines, to examine the data and to begin the task of deciphering meaning. A few months before this final hypnotic session, I met a young neurosurgeon who was also an art collector interested in my work. A conversation in my studio one day led around to the subject of UFOs. He was immediately curious about my investigations, though he remained neutral in his judgment of the phenomenon. One evening we listened together to a tape recording of a hypnotic regression and he was struck with the obvious sense one has of hearing a believable person recalling a frightening and very real experience. I told him about cases I had uncovered involving scars on the bodies of UFO abductees. Screwing up my courage, I asked him if he would ever do me the favor of examining one or two people, just to see what could be deduced from the character and location of these wound traces. He agreed, out of a mixture of friendship and curiosity. Stephen Kilburn's final hypnotic session had been so connected with the recall of what seemed to be a neurological examination that he became the logical candidate for the first appointment. Dr. Paul Cooper received Stephen at his Brooklyn hospital office about 10 days after this last hypnosis. I was not present, but a few hours after the time of the appointment, Dr. Cooper called me. I've just heard the spookiest two, and, a, half hours of my life, he told me. Stephen is a remarkable young man. He's extremely bright, an excellent observer, and totally believable. And really very, very decent, a nice human being. I was spellbound. Everything he told me about what they did to him and how his body reacted accorded exactly with what should have happened if they stimulated the different nerves he said they touched. I tried to mislead him, Dr. Cooper added. He said when they pressed here, and he indicated his femoral nerve, his thigh moved. I said, are you sure? Are you sure it wasn't elsewhere? He said, no, it was right here, I'm sure of it. I'd insist it couldn't have been where he said, just to try to mislead him, but he would always stick by his memory of it. He exactly described the motor reaction that happens when the femoral nerve is stimulated. And he has no particular knowledge of the nervous system. He'd have to have known a great deal to make it all up, and I'm certain he's not the type to lie. He's a very decent guy, and I'm really impressed with him. It's remarkable, the whole thing. He asked me what I thought they were doing when they went up and down his back with their machine, stimulating various nerves. I told him that it seemed to me they just wanted to find out how he worked. Dr. Cooper was unable, during the two, and, a, half-hour interview and examination, to find any unusual scars or puncture marks on Stephen's body. The tiny scar near his navel could have had any number of causes, but, then, Steve said it had only felt as if he had been opened up. He had never seen any blood or noticeable scar, and the encounter had happened 7 years before. I don't know what it all means, Paul Cooper told me, but it's remarkable. Fascinating. Really fascinating. I had to agree that no one else knows what it means, either. Not I, not Dr. Chamar, not Ted Blocher, and not even Stephen Kilburn, and he was there. The blue light in the Pine Barrens, Judy Kendall and her sisters, Barney and Betty Hill, Elaine Thomas, Mona Stafford, and numerous other people were, like Stephen Kilburn, abducted from automobiles by UFO occupants, who somehow took control of their vehicles. But there is a second basic abduction scenario, one that is, if anything, even more disturbing to contemplate. Many people have simply been taken from their homes while they were either asleep or involved in some quotidian activity, like watching television or reading. On October 7, 1979, I received a phone call from a good friend of mine, a man I shall refer to as Howard Rich. He was very distressed about what had happened to him the night before, yet he was unclear as to why it had affected him so deeply. Last night, I was just relaxing and watching television. I was visiting my mother in Toms River, New Jersey, and I was alone in a ground floor bedroom. About 11:30 or so, as I was watching this program, the room started to fill with light, very bright light, with a bluish tinge to it. It didn't seem to be shining in the window, it seemed to be there in the room with me. It got brighter and brighter, and then it began to diminish. The whole thing only lasted, say, about 3 seconds. But when it was over, it left me very frightened. I felt a deep sense of dread. It was really strange. I've never had anything like it happen before. I was really shaken. I got up and, I keep a gun in the house. I found it and loaded it and went outside to look around. I was that nervous. I didn't see anything unusual, so I came back in, but I still couldn't settle down and go to sleep. I took a Valium, but I couldn't relax. I finally got to sleep, but this morning I just thought I should call you and tell you about it. Howard is a gentle and pacific man. I was shocked to hear that he owned a pistol, and even more so that he loaded it and went outdoors. I asked him how much time he spent outside. Not very long, 4 or 5 minutes, probably. I walked around behind the house and didn't see anything unusual. Just to double check, I inquired if the same television program he had been watching was still on when he came back inside. Yes, it was, I think. I'm pretty sure. There wasn't any time problem or anything like that. I don't think anything really happened. It was just that it was so strange, and it left me so, feeling so nervous and apprehensive. Toms River is near Fort Dix, so I suggested he first call the police and report the incident, just to see if anyone else reported something similar, and then, I felt, he should call Fort Dix to inquire about any possible flare drops or nighttime military exercises. Finally, I said that he should ask his closest neighbors if they noticed anything unusual. Ironically, Howard's call came as Ted Blocher and Patrick Haig, another UFO investigator, were in my studio going over with me the tape recording I had made of a recent hypnotic regression session involving still another abduction. I finished my conversation with Howard and related it to Ted and Patrick. I told them that I had been struck by his deep and continuing uneasiness, though there seemed to be no time lapse nor any other clues that might imply a more complex experience than he could consciously recall. Howard knew a little about the UFO phenomenon, but had no real sense of the abduction cases we were investigating. He had served in the Air Force for 3 years and had heard of a number of Air Force UFO incidents. The loaded gun, I found out later, he acquired when a job he held for a year or so involved his driving alone back and forth across the country, sometimes carrying a respectable amount of cash. I called Howard the following day to see what he had learned from the various lines of inquiry I had suggested. The local police had received no other reports of unusual lights or flares. When he spoke to the information officer at Fort Dix, he was told that there had been no nighttime military exercises of any kind. An interesting side light here, however, was the way the information officer began to question Howard about what he had seen. Almost, he felt, as if the officer had a prepared list of questions to ask anyone reporting unusual lights. The neighbors also had seen nothing out of the ordinary, though they mentioned the fact that they had had an unusually restless night. A few weeks after his initial call to me, Howard and I were together at a dinner party. He mentioned again how unnerved he had been by the incident of the blue light. I said that, if he was curious, perhaps I could arrange an appointment with Dr. Claymore so that he could undergo hypnosis, and, at the least, he would recall all the details of his experience and would most probably be able to put the matter to rest. I honestly did not think that there was much to discover. I felt that the vivid light might have been some kind of half dream in the mind and eye of a drowsy, late-night television viewer. The only thing that I did wonder about was his intense reaction. On the stimulus side of the ledger, there wasn't much, just a bright, momentarily light, filled bedroom. But on the other side of the ledger, the response side, there was a very deep, very sustained, fearful reaction that did not seem to have an adequate cause. I should have known from Stephen Kilburn's case that an intense reaction with this kind of vague stimulus is itself a definite clue, an indication that perhaps there is more stimulus, and that it has just been effectively blocked. On March 8, 1980, almost exactly 5 months after the incident, an appointment I had set up for someone else with Dr. Chemar was cancelled, and, almost on a whim, I called Howard and asked if he wouldn't be interested in taking it himself. He agreed. We went to her office by cab, talking all the while about everything except UFOs and the mysterious, light-filled bedroom. On the first appointment, Dr. Claymore usually conducts an informal interview with the subject to gather background information and to better understand his or her general character and psychological make-up. After this, she induces a trance state so that the subject can experience hypnosis in a relaxed and neutral way. Regression to a specific earlier event is something that is usually not attempted until the second appointment. Howard entered Dr. Claymore's office feeling somewhat apprehensive and nervous, but her direct and cheerful style immediately won him over. I waited outside during the obviously confidential interview. When she had completed the conversation and preliminary trial run hypnosis, she asked me to join them. Howard looked relaxed, though there was a slight cloud over his usually happy and open countenance. He is a youthful 38 years old, tall, the kind of man women find very attractive in an easy, brotherly way. Prior to his interview, he had told Dr. Claymore and me his story once again, and I recorded it before leaving the room. It was in a place called Tom's River, New Jersey, near the Pine Barrens, which is near Fort Dix, and it's kind of a strange place. I don't know how really to describe it, but it has a funny ambience about it, at least, I feel it. I was staying at my mother's house. She has a condominium in a retirement community. It was a Saturday night, probably around midnight, and I was watching television and doing some reading, and I think I had maybe a glass of sherry, and I was tired. I was half-heartedly watching TV. The TV was on the desk. There was a small light on the desk, probably a 60-watt bulb, in a pretty big room, so it wasn't very bright. There was one window in the bedroom that faces east. Suddenly, the room seemed to have an incredible, intense light in it, with a blue tinge to it, that built in intensity the way a strobe light would, but it was of longer duration. I'd guess it was almost 3 seconds. HR is an accomplished photographer, so these descriptions and estimates are probably quite accurate. It built, peaked, and then became dim again, and then the room seemed to be darker than it was originally, as if the bulb had gone down a bit, and I had an incredible feeling of fear and apprehension, and almost, see if I can find another word to fit it, but I guess fear and apprehension fit it best. And maybe it's my mind. But everything seemed to become very quiet at the same time. Do you know how, after an automobile accident, in the city when you hear cars crash, for a split second after that everything stops? Well, that kind of sound happened, or lack of sound. There are always background sounds, woods sounds, animal sounds. But I guess there was a pause there, and I still had that feeling of fear and apprehension. I used to travel a lot and I kept a loaded pistol in the house, and for some reason I got the pistol and went, out of the house, outside, looking around, because I felt there was danger out there. I felt it outside, all around the house there was this feeling that there was something there, or, something happened. And I guess nothing happened. I didn't encounter anything. There was nothing out there, and eventually I came back in. I guess I was outside maybe 4 or 5 minutes, walking around the grass and woods. Then I went back in and I was still shaken. It took me a long time to calm down. I had another glass of sherry, and went to sleep about 30 minutes to an hour after that. And that was it. There was residue after that, the next few days. I still felt tense and apprehensive. After the session, Howard and I left the office and went out to the street in search of a cab.